She's a.
What's good, people? I'm Ben Stacy, and this is the one and only State of American Music Podcast. If it's your first time stopping by, essentially what we do here is take any dead American musician and cover the impact that they had on the American musical and cultural landscape. The subject of discussion today is the legend John Coltrane, particularly his album Blue Train. I chose Blue Train because, in my experience, Blue Train, at least in the eye of the public, tends to be outshined by a lot of Coltrane's other works, i.e. A Love Supreme, My Favorite Things, Giant Steps, etc. And if you ask me, that's a shame because Blue Train came at a pivotal point in Coltrane's life. Blue Train marked the beginning of a hot streak Coltrane would go on in the years immediately following 1958. So get the music bumping and let's get into it. To fully understand Blue Train's significance, you must understand Coltrane's upbringing. Coltrane was brought up as a Methodist in Hamlet, North Carolina. His last name, Coltrane, was the name of the white slave owners that were the masters to his ancestors. This was a common thing you'd see at the time, where blacks living in the U.S. would take the names of their ancestors' former masters, as opposed to taking their native African name. Being the ancestor of African slave, obviously Coltrane was by no means immune to racial hardships during his life. And he, as did a lot of these blues-derived jazz musicians of the early 20th century, acted as a sort of activist for racial barriers in this country. Many times he spoke about the mistreatment of black people in America. Even the great Haki Madhubuti, you know, well-respected black poet, educator, and activist, addressed Coltrane in a poem titled, Don't Cry, Scream. The poem, of course, was about the commodification and exploitation of blacks in the U.S. In the opening stanza, the poem literally reads, "Into the 60s, a train came out of the 50s. So you know, that's a pretty big deal, having your name directly called upon in a piece of literature written by an extremely successful and educated black poet and activist. The fact that Madhubuti would directly reference Coltrane by name in this poem shows Coltrane's involvement within the circles of black activism, empowerment, as well as just the fight against racism. With that being said, by his teens, Coltrane displayed an apparent natural talent for the saxophone. In 1939, his father would die and then his mother shortly after. This would leave Coltrane and his family in huge financial struggles. His family would head up to New Jersey in hopes of a better life, but Coltrane stayed behind in North Carolina to finish high school. In 1943, after already being graduated from high school, Coltrane had moved to Pennsylvania to pursue a career in music. But he couldn't even really get the ball rolling with that because, you know, World War II was a thing and duty called. Coltrane enlisted in the Navy and served through the rest of the war. Once he came back, Coltrane, similar to what we see with pretty much what seems like every single other musician to ever exist, developed a drug problem. Addicted, yet still extremely talented, he got a sweet gig in the Miles Davis Quintet. If you're a regular here, you know all about the legend Miles Davis. We talked about him a few months ago. Funny story, according to John Scheinfeld's documentary Chasing Train, Coltrane would often go on these amazing yet extremely long solos as a member of the Miles Davis Quintet. These solos would often go longer than Davis's solos. This just goes to show how talented this guy really was. Outshining Miles Davis in his own quintet? Impressive to say the least. Working together, Coltrane and Davis had great success in the mid-50s. This was, however, the peak of Coltrane's habitual heroin usage. Davis would often tell Coltrane to clean up his habits. However, Coltrane would never listen, and in 1957, Davis fired Coltrane from the quintet. This was perhaps maybe the last straw for Coltrane, as he would quit all drug and alcohol usage cold turkey shortly after his firing. This brings us to 1958, which is the year he released Blue Train, the album of discussion today. As I said before, Blue Train came at a pivotal crossroad in Coltrane's life. He had just beaten heroin for good after all it had costed him being kicked out of the Miles Davis Quintet. And in 1958, Coltrane flipped the switch in a sense. His focus changed from the, you know, whatever, go with the flow, do drugs mentality, to now him being much more focused on expanding his musical abilities and fully maximizing his true potential as a musician. Right now, Coltrane doesn't know it yet, but these next 8 years or so are going to be monumental for him. He's about to enter his prime, if you will. In the opening track of the album, titled Blue Train, Coltrane is accompanied by quite a few of his friends from the Miles Davis Quintet, including Billy Jones Drew on the drums, Paul Chambers on the bass, and others. This song opens with a wild solo from Coltrane himself. Man goes crazy on the saxophone for a little bit. My interpretation of the opening solo is that it represents the hectic life of a heroin addict. It could also symbolize the euphoric rush of a heroin high. After the first few hectic minutes, the song chills out and takes a more organized and on-schedule tone to it. The latter part of the song represents the security and certainty that the future holds for Coltrane. He is finally heroin-free and can now fully focus on his career as a musician. It is also important to note that a lot of the last part of the song is played by members of the Miles Davis Quintet. Look, I can't confirm that the reason Coltrane quit was directly related to him being fired from the quintet, but that would make a lot of sense to me. With this in mind, it is symbolic that the safe and secure portion of the song is played by mostly members of Miles Davis' group, considering that they're the ones who brought that similar security to Coltrane's life. They're the ones that opened Coltrane's eyes and really held that mirror up to his face, enabling him to turn his life around. By kicking him out of the group, they kind of told Coltrane, "Hey idiot, wake up," giving Coltrane that spark he needed to jumpstart the prime of his career and probably life. This complete switch in Coltrane's mindset shows grit and is actually pretty inspiring. If you put yourself in his shoes, he's a black, heroin-addicted war veteran who lived through a pretty tough home life as a child, finally one day coming to the realization that he has to choose between the life of being a good-for-nothing, heroin-addicted bum or pursuing something that he obviously had a lot of talent and passion for, being music. This is when Coltrane became Coltrane, and to be honest, it displays the true American identity of manifesting your future and taking your destiny into your own hands. The next track on the album, Moment's Notice, starts off as fast-paced as the opening solo in the last track, but it carries that same speed and energy throughout the entirety of the track. The synchronization between the artists seems smooth and natural. The transitions between solos seem to happen at a moment's notice. Coltrane opens with a solo, and as usual, he kills it. Then Curtis Fuller comes in on the trombone, and man, it's a killer. I'll tell you, I didn't know a trombone could go that hard. Overall, this track is a fun bop, and is just meant for the audience to close their eyes and absorb. The fluidity and passion that Coltrane displays on the saxophone in this track, and just his career in general, is truly astonishing. A comparison I like to make to Coltrane is modern-day mumble rap slash trap music. Everybody loves to hate on modern rap, especially old heads. I find it ironic because the same old heads that will tell you that mumble rappers and trap artists are talentless will praise Coltrane as a legend. When you think about it, they are in essence doing the same thing. They both use abstract sounds to get messages across. Coltrane barely had any lyrics in his songs. There are literally zero words in the entire album Blue Train. Yet Blue Train and all the rest of Coltrane's works are still widely renowned as great. A lot of hip-hop artists do something very similar. Take Playboi Carti for example. His music is highly popular despite the fact that no one even knows what he is saying half the time. Even though he is mumbling his words, you can still catch the drift of his music. Both artists' music do not rely on the listener to be actively interpreting lyrics. You can just sit back, relax, and vibe out. The notion that these trap artists are talentless is, in my opinion, preposterous. If people are making millions of dollars off it and it takes no talent, then why doesn't everybody do it? The facts are, the reason everyone doesn't do it is because not everyone can. While artists such as Coltrane, Playboi Carti, Future, Lil Uzi Vert, and so many more are able to do is make something out of nothing through music. They can make catchy yet meaningful songs without directly laying it out for the listener. While listening to their music, the listener is left to sort of fill in the blanks for a lot of the music, and that's part of the appeal. It is sort of the musical equivalent to abstract art. Throughout most of history, music has traditionally utilized lyrics to send messages to audiences. What makes the artist's music so special is the mysterious nature they have to them. Just by listening to it, you get the gist of it, and there are still elements left on the table to be interpreted. That's the beauty of it. You can make whatever you want. In conclusion, Coltrane's a genius and a legend. Don't hate on Playboi Carti because you couldn't do better.
This show was produced and hosted by yours truly, Ben Stacy.
I'ma let Coltrane send y'all out. See you later. Peace.